Right now, it's time for our weekly conversation with our friend, writer, and critic, Colin Fleming. Colin, good afternoon.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Have you, you gotten over the Super Bowl yet?
Yeah, I was crestfallen. I didn't enjoy that. Not a fun Sunday night, but time and tide waits for no man, and life rolls on.
Absolutely, and well, it's the Patriots and professional sports in general that we want to talk about. And you wrote about this in USA Today over the weekend, and it's the notion that competence is sometimes confused for something greater than that.
I think it's more so the notion that competence is the new sort of apex of achievement. Competence has become something that replaces talent, which seems to be on its way out for a host of reasons, I think. And so what ends up happening is it's almost like manna when we meet someone who basically is not completely rubbish at their job. And a lot of my job involves writing people, most of whom will ignore me, but I probably send out about 10,000 words worth of stuff a week. And I've noticed you can even track it over 6 months. That the person that used to maybe get back to you in 3 weeks, it's 3 months now, it's 5 months. You can actually feel it at that kind of like quotidian, day in, day out level, where someone, if they just do their job, you just want to bow down and think, wow, thank you so much. What a great relief this oasis is.
Well, and why is that acceptable? We've talked about this in a sports sense, that Major League Baseball is a great example. There seem to be cities, franchises, ownership groups who are more than willing to write off even a shot at a championship. Why do people tolerate that?
It's like drugs. It's enabling, really, I think. I think a lot of people have so much panic and fear inside of them in terms of what they believe they should be and what they're fearful they are not. And so they have a kind of stage presentation of themselves that they put out there to the world. You'll notice if someone has any interest in anything, it can just be like, oh, on occasion, I like to go to a museum. They'll almost always preface the expression of that interest with a disclaimer. I know it's so nerdy, but it's like, dude, relax. It's okay to like interesting things. You don't just have to be about saying you're about the Netflix all the time. And I think what happens then is expectations become scaled back. And because no one polices the individual person, including the person themselves, if no one is complaining and the Facebook likes are rolling in, other people who also count on those likes, so the enablers enable the other enablers, well, the system just rolls on unchecked and we become desensitized, we become disconnected. And there's very little true connection between people and with people with themselves. And I think mediocrity then becomes something that's very non-threatening, whereas talent, let alone genius, terrifies these people.
We've talked about this before, too, and you write a lot. You are incredibly productive. Not everybody is productive. And part of that, too, is because of these diversions, the time sucks that are out there. And so I wonder if you think that which one is the chicken and which one is the egg? Are people less productive because these diversions are pulling them away? Or do they seek those diversions to avoid attempting and perhaps failing at productivity?
The combo. Look, I'll have like a Saturday morning where I'll have something in the New York Times and I'll be on NPR. That'll be at the end of a week where I've been in Salon and Rolling Stone and Washington Post, whatever else. And what will happen to me then is 30 people would befriend me on Facebook, and it will become harder for me to get work because people know about these things. Then the green beast rears its head. And that's not because someone necessarily hates me, although that's what it ends up looking like. They're dissatisfied with the fact that 10:30, they're still in bed. This guy is doing this. I don't want to hear about this. This is depressing to me. Oh, and he just walked 12 miles? This is irksome. I'll show him. So they don't have to actually say, you know what, I can get up. I can do some stuff. Maybe I can't do some of that, but I can do my things. And other people maybe can't do those, and we can all kind of push each other a little bit. But that doesn't happen. It becomes really, again, that lack of accountability. No one is ever saying, hey, look, do this. You can do better. If people are not complaining and your check is coming in and you're sleeping in and your friends are, you know, being your friends, basically, in some kind of, like, fake way, but maybe you can't tell, you can lie to yourself, you're okay with it. And I think that's what happens. So when we have individuality now, and we have effort, and we have talent, which means nothing without effort, well, I think that person can become a pariah because that threatens that status quo.
Now, some people will look at play as the opposite of work, but I'm willing to bet that you believe differently, that play is a component of work and can make that work even better. Let's talk about play, real play, where you let yourself and let your imagination go.
I think a little child is oftentimes smarter than an adult. You go out somewhere, say you're at the cafe, and the parent comes in with their kid, and the kid kind of, maybe there's another one, so one kid wanders off. That child views the world with a capacity for wonder that it will eventually be scrubbed out of that child, probably. But they're looking at things as though this is the most fascinating thing I've ever seen. If you're on like the subway here in Boston, you can see certain people, not many, they're not staring at their phone. They have an alertness to their eyes where they're, oh, what's that placard up there say? Oh, look at that woman who got on. She's wearing an interesting kind of shawl. You can see them engaged with the world. And I think that's in some ways what play is. I'll be walking down the street on one of my 10-mile walks. I'll find a pine cone. Well, I'm going to be Pele for a couple blocks. It's just like a silly thing. But it's that same kind of thinking that informs other thinking, like, all right, by the time we get to the end of the next block, I want you to come up with four characters. And we'll distribute them to different short stories in the future. But give me some characters. What are they doing? What are they doing right now if they're out there in the world? And that's just the way you had mentioned before that we don't allow kids to be bored. And I think that's true, too. It's just this constant bombardment where it's like, well, we're not going to let you think. And you're not going to let yourself think. And you, again, become, as with mediocrity, desensitized to everything around you.
40 years ago today was the start of the blizzard of 78. I have my own vivid memories from that time. But for you, this was in many ways a life-changing experience, even though you were what, all of 2 years old?
I was two, but there had been snow. And I had snow in my mind. I was very clear on what snow was. And I knew even then that that was a bit different. I remember being outside with my dad pulling me around in the sled. And these were mountains of snow. It reminded me of some of the scenes in like the Rankin Bass Rudolph special, which I'm convinced that Radiohead lifted for their Kid A album cover. And I just thought, wow, this world is this visitation almost upon like our regular kind of samey world. And it just got me thinking. You'd see these crevasses and these huge boulders of ice and snow that the plows had pushed aside, and I just was thinking in terms of like, well, how's if I'm being pulled along in my sled, and I look inside one of these gaps, and like, I see someone looking out at me. I can't even like talk right now, but I was kind of thinking like in terms of narrative. I was like, imagine if you had someone like that in the story. That's like, you're just out there hanging out in the snow, but it gave me this new sense of possibility. I imagine maybe, say, there was some boy slightly older than me who loved to play outside in the snow, but he didn't enjoy anything else but the snow, what would his life be like in the summer? And I would kind of imagine in my head, writing like, I didn't know I was writing a story at the time, but I look back on it later, these characters, and again, what were they doing out there in the world, even though technically they didn't exist? And it's just that capacity for wonder that I think as adults we have to challenge ourselves to retain, or we're just not going to be an active presence, not just in our own lives, but in our relationships and what we might discover and how we might even hear music or look at a painting on the wall or watch a coach's decision not to play a guy in coverage. You know, it all sort of informs the way you experience and feel and think everything.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. He is over that Super Bowl completely. Don't listen to him when he talks that way. Let's talk about hockey. Last night, you were at the Bean Pot, a great annual Boston tradition.
Yes, I was at the Bean Pot. I was there late at the Bean Pot because the second game, which BU took, went to overtime. So it'll be BU versus Northeastern in the final. And mentioned talking about the blizzard, I was just, I was not at the Bean Pot in 1978. I didn't start going until really the late 90s, I think. But it's just this fantastic story of people who were at that Bean Pot in 78 with the blizzard. They got snowed in, and they were at the Old Garden. I just was hearing that report, and I thought, like, you know what? That would be a great start for a short story. someone is there because of this circumstance, and maybe in this confined area that they can't leave, right? Had no choice, basically. They are forced to confront, I don't know, some person from their past who happens to be there. And it just got me thinking again about snow and that blizzard and being 2 years old, and also how I would go into the room where my dad was watching hockey when I was a kid. And even before I could talk, I would hear these sounds of Fred Cusick. And I always associate him with hockey announcers. And it just made me think that words, they don't just have like their actual meaning. They have a kind of sonic resonance to them. So I'm sitting there watching last night and hearing all of that again through two, you know, the sounds of the rink, the puck off the boards and everything. There's this kind of like concerto aspect to hockey that, you know what, I don't think I'd even have picked up on if I wasn't someone who retained that quality of play. I'd just be a guy sitting there, it's getting late, I hope someone scores soon.
My story of the blizzard of 78 is not quite as exciting as being trapped at the Garden, but being voluntarily trapped. I was a young radio guy, and the blizzard was coming, and I worked at a place across town that had two radio stations and a TV station, and the general manager said, we need volunteers to stay. And this was on a Tuesday, and he said, we're probably not going to get anybody back here until Thursday. So we need a couple people who can hang out and cover both radio stations and TV. And I gladly volunteered. It sounded like an adventure with another guy. And we stayed there and manned two radio stations, a TV station, which meant doing the 6 o'clock and the 11 o'clock TV news. He was a guy who had to shave about every 4 hours. And by the Wednesday night late news, looked like Lon Chaney Jr., ready to bay at the moon. But it was a great adventure. And I think it's one of the things that, if I didn't love radio already, that thrill of being in this situation when you knew everybody else was listening to radio somewhere because they couldn't get out of the house.
It sounds like a rosier version of, you ever see the Howard Hawks movie, The Thing from Another World?
Yes.
They're at like the science station, which is kind of like a radio station.
Yeah,
like,
oh, yeah.
A little bit. There's like an antenna, and they like have walkie-talkies and everything, and they're just on site having this on-site adventure. And I mean, let's face it, a lot of the adventures you're going to have in life, such that you have, are not going to be like a Munson style or Melville going out on the Whaler. It's going to be like at your office or at a radio station like that during a snowstorm or at a hockey rink at night. And if you're not that little kid at the Starbucks who wants to kind of leave his mother's side and wander around a little bit, your life is going to be awfully tedious. In fact, I would say you're not even really going to be living. You're just going to be kind of like raising your hand like you do in attendance and say, I'm here. And that, to me, is just not very much. I wonder what the point is of that.
We're talking with Colin Fleming. And before we let you go, I want to bring it up because you posted about the passing last night on Facebook, of the passing of the great actor John Mahoney, so brilliant in Frasier, but so many movies, so many television shows through the years. A pro, and a lot of people may not know the story, that he was British and didn't begin his acting career until he was in his mid to late 30s.
Classic character actor, like in the way, like if you go back to a lot of those British ensembles, like those mid-century British ensembles, I wonder, like, he must have just seen so many of those as a kid because that was kind of like the role he was sort of in. British actors in those films, they always seemed, right, like Mervyn Jones, they seemed older than they were.
It's
you
true.
Look them up on Wikipedia later, it's like, dude, you're 43. You look like you're like 64. And when you think about this, so he died, he's only 77, and Frasier premiered in 93, right? So
yeah,
he's kind of supposed to be old and a little crotchety on the show, right? But he's like awfully young when it starts out. He's not that much older, right? Can't be, than Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah, right. Less, I would say a decade, no more than that.
And yet he had that separation. Part of it was that gravelly voice, and he had kind of those like Irish like eyes, right? That kind of. But yeah, wonderful character actor. You mentioned 8 Men Out, right? A lot of people have been posting about that today. Maybe the best baseball film of the last 30 plus years. It's been a while. I think it's like right up there.
Yeah, and
more than.
One of the more interesting father-daughter relationships in film, too, in Say Anything with Ione Skye.
Yeah, someone mentioned that to me today, and there was the type of thing, too, that I think this person who mentioned it was a father. So it seems to be something they pick up on. And, yes, people... But I always thought of that more of a John Cusack thing. That was kind of his vehicle, whereas I felt that this particular actor, his real sort of meaty roles were in ensembles. I mean, Eight Men Out is such an ensemble. Like, who would you even say is the main character? Like, there kind of really isn't one, right? And he's in that position in that film of, like, kind of knowing but not knowing. And that's just a difficult kind of dichotomy to pull off. He does it on Frasier, where he's basically charming, and at the same time, he can't stand his sons, but he's very loving, too, towards them as well. So, yeah, great, great, great actor that I think a lot of people have seen in a lot of things, but might not have known him by name.
Absolutely. Colin Fleming joins us every Tuesday afternoon here on Downtown. Thank you, my friend. As always, we look forward to catching up with you again next week.
All right, sounds good.